You say Miami is now one of the world's superstar cities. What does that mean?
Well, you know, I've been looking at this for a long time now, and I wrote a book about it called The New Urban Crisis that was published in the spring. And we were able to rank, you know, the world's most economically powerful cities, or when you say city, it really is a metropolitan area, like the greater New York area, the greater Miami area, or greater Tokyo, or greater London. And when you look at that, you know, there's just a couple dozen of cities around the world that really set the tempo and tenor of the world economy. At the top of, very top of that list are New York and London. And then you have places like Hong Kong and Singapore and Los Angeles and Paris. But, you know, right below that, you have Miami and other cities, Toronto, where I spend part of my time, and others. But Miami has emerged as one of the world's great global cities. And in particular, one, it's big. It has a big economy. I think the economy here now is as big as Singapore or Hong Kong. Two, it has a lot of people. Three, it has this particular role, you know, which is very interesting because the United States is a big country with several coasts. And this particular role as really the hub of Latin American and South American and Caribbean commerce. But for all those reasons, Miami is one of the great superstar cities. And what I call it is people have talked about winner-take-all economies or winner-take-all talent, great basketball stars or football players or business founders or entrepreneurs or CEOs or entertainers like Beyonce or Jay-Z, who make a gazillion dollars, you know, because they're very good at what they do. It's kind of becoming that way with cities. You know, you're either one of the, I call it winner-take-all urbanism or winner-take-all cities. You're either a winner or you're not. And, you know, one of the good things is that Miami is one of the winners. The other thing that's happening, though, is that the gap between the winners and the losers is growing. So it's a good thing that Miami's a winner. But as a country, we face this kind of growing gap between winners and losers.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that. So it's a good thing. Doesn't sound bad to say superstar city, and it's a winner. But where does you said crisis? Where does the crisis come in now?
Well, you know, if you think about Miami, and you're old enough to remember the old Miami, businesses moved out to the suburbs. The middle class moved out to the suburbs. This happened in almost every large American city. But of course, over the past 20 years, and I've been really coming to Miami for 10, the amount of change that we've seen in this region, city and region, in the past 10 years is astounding. A whole new skyline. You know, people moving back to areas of Miami that no one would have ever thought. Never mind downtown, Wynwood, the Design District. We could go on and on. Parts of South Beach that were run down. And in many ways, when I talk about the new urban crisis, it's a crisis of success. As our cities have come back, as these vibrant downtown neighborhoods have bounced back, as housing prices has risen, we've experienced this kind of hyper-gentrification. The richest people have moved back to the downtowns, forcing less affluent people out. So what we've seen is even the winners, the great New York, Miami, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Boston, Washington, D.C., have experienced this new, that's what I call it, a new urban crisis, which is really a crisis in part of success. As they become increasingly divided, you know, the old urban crisis, the middle class left the city. The new urban crisis is the middle class and the middle class neighborhoods are being eviscerated in the city and the suburbs. And really our community, like many other communities, is dividing into these small areas. You see it, drive around Miami, you see it. Small areas of very concentrated affluence, surrounded by much larger spans of concentrated disadvantage with a middle and middle class neighborhoods that are increasingly missing.
So it sounds like people with good jobs, that's great for them. And it's, you know, it's an unaffordable place with folks with lower incomes. And that's where Miami really has that crisis, is the number of people with lower incomes, it's growing, or it's way bigger than those who have.
Sure. We divide the world, my team and I, into three major economic groups. There are the knowledge workers, the professional workers, the innovators, the entrepreneurs that kind of power this new urban-based economy. That, in the United States, is about a third of the workforce. It's slightly less of the workforce here. There's the old blue-collar working class, the factory workers, the truck drivers, the construction workers. That, in the United States, is about 20%. And again, in greater Miami, those middle-class jobs are even less. The biggest class in America, economic group, is what we call the service class. They're the people who work in retail jobs, office and clerical work, personal services, hospitality and tourism, the carry professions. They take care of our kids and our aging parents. In the United States, it's about 45% of the workforce. In Miami, that's over 50%. We're becoming an innovative knowledge economy, but we're still one of the world's preeminent service economies. If a knowledge worker, on average, makes, say, six figures, roughly low six figures, a service worker may make 20 or 30 grand. Here's the rub. When you look at the amount of money these people take home after they pay for their housing, that's when people get clobbered. You know, that knowledge worker, even if housing is expensive, still has enough, makes enough, and in some ways their wages are hinged to housing prices. So to recruit them, you've got to pay them a little more if you're in an expensive city. The service workers just get killed. And, you know, Miami, that's where Miami is really suffering, that we have such a hospitality and tourism economy and our housing prices, no, it's not San Francisco level or New York level or Los Angeles level, have gotten high enough that those folks are getting killed. And you know, we miss a middle. It wasn't only the middle class that powered the American dream. It was these middle class neighborhoods. I grew up in one in Newark. My parents moved to a suburb called North Arlington. My dad was a factory worker. He could buy a home and put his two kids through college. Those middle-class neighborhoods are being eliminated, and that's kind of the crisis we're feeling here in Miami.
And, you know, one of the things that we hear a lot, of course, is the economic inequality. That's another part of the issue with the crisis. Well, how bad is Miami compared to some of these other cities when we talk about that inequality?
It's pretty bad. And in the report we're releasing today on Miami's new urban crisis, we slice and dice it. For folks listening in, there are many, many ways to measure income inequality, wage inequality, the top 5%, the top 1%. The news is Miami doesn't do well on any of them. You know, it isn't quite in the circumstance of New York or San Francisco or Los Angeles, but it's right up there. And in many ways, our concentrated poverty is even worse. So it's bad, you know, and Miami, although it is growing and attracting people and attracting immigrants from all over the world, not just Latin America, in the past couple of days, I've had three Uber drivers from Turkey. I mean, so it is attracting people from Russia and Asia and all over the world now. But one of the things that's really daunting is as we grow, our level of inequality is increasing. Now, here's the thing, though. This is true of all cities. The more knowledge-based, the more technology-based, the more innovative, the more entrepreneurial, the more highly educated, the more unequal they are. That's that crisis of success. It's almost, if you do everything right to grow your economy because of the way our economies are set up and our cities are set up today, by the very fact that you're growing, you polarize or you pull apart. And I think one of the things we have to figure out as a country and as a region is how do we move from this, what I call the winner-take-all urbanism, to a more urbanism or a city for all, a kind of more inclusive prosperity. And that's really what we're trying to figure out.
You talked about how many, what percentage of jobs in our area are service jobs, service-related jobs, which tend to be the lower-paying jobs. And Miami is extremely high compared to some of these other big cities that you mentioned. Is there a breaking point? Is there a number, like if too many of our jobs are dependent on that really it hurts the city more than it's going to help the city?
No, I think, you know, there are several things we need to do here to kind of make our community more inclusive and to make our prosperity more inclusive. But one of them is that we have to become a laboratory and a leader for making service jobs better jobs. You know, my dad used to tell me lots of stories, but you know, he got a job at age 13 in a factory in Newark, New Jersey, and it took nine people to make a family living wage. You know, granddad, grandma, my dad, and his six brothers and sisters. He came back from the war in the late 1940s, and as if by magic, that crappy factory job had become a great family-supporting job. We had unions, we had collective bargaining, we had legislation, the New Deal. We decided as a society to make factory work, turn it from bad jobs to good jobs. That's kind of what we have to do today. And because we have such a well-organized tourism industry, hospitality industry, hotel industry, these big companies, you know, the way they upgraded manufacturing work was they involved workers on the factory floor in productivity improvement. They became sources of innovative ideas. Well, the person in a retail shop can actually configure the clothes and the shopping in a better way. The person in a grocery store can make that store more appealing. The janitor can look at see what windows are opened and where energy is being wasted. That trick of moving from seeing the worker as a cost to an asset, and it's happening. You know, the best service companies across this country, Whole Foods, Costco, even Starbucks now, they're beginning to change their mindset and see service workers as an asset. So, and I think that's what we have to do here.
But you, when you talk about those jobs decades ago, they created the middle class. So you had those factory jobs, the blue collar worker jobs, and the unions, as you mentioned, helped create the middle class. Can these service jobs elevate to the point where it creates helps strengthen the middle class?
We have no other choice. I mean, as a country, we can't leave 66 million Americans behind. And think, remember this. The equity piece of this is really important because those jobs are disproportionately female. They're disproportionately Latino, Hispanic, African American, or minority. They are a big part of what we're dealing with as a society. So I think we have no other choice but to upgrade those jobs. We can't condemn 66 million Americans to an underclass way of life. The good news is, I think, when I'm going around talking about the book in city after city, people are waking up to this. Big companies are waking up to this. Universities are waking up to this. Hospital and medical centers, these so-called anchor institutions, which anchor and spur urban revival. I think there's a general commitment, and I think there's a reason. You know, and I don't want to be too political, but our federal government has decided that it's no longer in the business of providing a social safety net for the American people. That's what Trump and the Republican Party are up to, like it or not. So what's happened is that if you want a social safety net in your community, you're turning to your local government, you're turning to your local anchor institutions, you're turning to local companies and saying, why don't you pitch in? And what's so interesting to me is all across this country, not only here, I'm seeing local companies, local governments, local anchor institutions saying, you know what? We can do this. We spurred the urban revival. We brought Miami or New York or Indianapolis or Milwaukee or Minneapolis back or Philadelphia. We can now undertake this effort to make service jobs better jobs, create more affordable housing, invest whatever we need to invest in transit, and make our community more inclusive.
Can they do that? And at the same time, cities want to go out and attract that young entrepreneur. They want to attract, that investment in startups, especially tech startups. But when you bring those folks in, and of course, when you bring in artists, you have gentrification, you have, you know, the buildup of these communities, ones that were not so affluent now becoming affluent shoves a lot of people out. Can you attract all of that and still do all of these things you say, which is, of course, to lift up the bottom half of your community that you need to be stronger?
So I think we have no other choice but to do both of them. I think you won't grow in this environment unless you attract talented people. Talented immigrants. We did a report last year that showed only San Jose, the Silicon Valley, was more dependent on talented and educated immigrants than Miami. We were number two. You need to bring in those innovators and entrepreneurs that create great companies. You need to bring the artists and creatives. By the way, a huge edge for Miami, another report we did, is this creative economy, and not just techies, the artists and multimedia people related to our new entertainment industry. But as you do that, you divide your society. So crisis of success. As you build a more successful, economically thriving economy, because we're no longer a factory economy, because we're a knowledge economy, you pull apart. So at the same time, what I think we need to do now is push up the bottom. We need to develop a strategy for more inclusive prosperity, which means making service jobs better jobs, paying these low-wage people better wages. It means you and I have to pay a little bit more for the services, you know, but during the New Deal, we decided to pay a little bit more for our cars and our washing machines and our refrigerators. And we've got to commit, you know, to making sure we're not only building luxury penthouse apartments and multimillion dollar homes for these rich people. We've got to commit to building affordable housing. And I think in this region, we've got to put transit back on the table. I mean, the All Aboard Florida is a great thing, but, you know, we're a metropolitan area of now approaching 6 million people. We're congested as all get out. You can't get around in a car anymore. And only a certain group of people can afford a car. We've now got to put not only better jobs for low-wage people, better affordable housing, but we've got to put transit back on the table. And that's what this Miami Urban Future Initiative that I'm part of is really trying to talk about.
you talk about some of the things that we have to do to strengthen our community. Let's go through some of these. One, you've talked about in your report, raising the minimum wage. That's been discussed. Obviously, the folks in Tallahassee, not that big on the idea. You also have to convince business owners, hey, because some of them have said, I'm going to go out of business if I have to do that. So how do we get past those hurdles?
This is really interesting. About 20% of Americans now have any level of faith and trust in their federal government at all. We're split right down the middle on our state governments, probably because half of us are Republicans and half of us are Democrats. So half of us like the government we have at any given time. And Tallahassee's not really going to help us all that much. And that's true in many states across the country. But about 3/4 of Americans have a high level of faith and confidence in their local level of government, their local city government, their metropolitan area. That tells me that the solution is local. And that brings me to the minimum wage. We have a debate that's pie in the sky. We need this number, and it should be that number, and maybe in many places it's $15. What we say is there's an empirically reasonable way to pursue the minimum wage, which means it should be pegged to your cost of living. New York's cost of living or San Francisco's cost of living or Washington, D.C.'s cost of living is actually much higher than Miami. And right about 50% of the local median wage is the right peg. So what we say is that, you know, the right minimum wage for Miami or Orlando or Tallahassee or Gainesville is different. And each community needs a minimum wage, which is about 50% of the prevailing median. And that's the right wage that won't put small business operators back on their heels. If you go higher than that, and when communities have gone higher than that, it tends to backfire. So yes. And I think in a service economy, you know, it says something very important to your community, these hardworking people, that, you know, if you're going to break your back doing these service jobs, we're going to have a floor, you know, which is a humane floor, 50% of the local prevailing median wage. And that's going to be the wage that you can expect to make. So, yeah, we need to put that on the table. And I think we need to politically mobilize to support it.
All right. Let's talk about affordable housing. That's another big challenge, obviously, here in South Florida, especially in Miami. But, you know, it's a gold mine for developers and for people in real estate. But now you got to convince them, and you also got to get the local politicians to agree to push a little harder to create these kind of opportunities. If not, if I'm a person in the real estate industry, well, that, you know, luxury condo is going to make me a lot happier than building housing for folks who can't afford to get me a bigger commission. I mean, you see where I'm going here.
So in cities across the country, principally San Francisco, New York, Los Angeles, developers are negotiating with city governments are negotiating with developers for inclusionary zoning. If you want to build a taller building, if you want to get a variance to add density, if you want to build a skyscraper, you've got to give something back. And what you give back is affordable units. And, you know, people talk about the poor door in New York City housing, but I spend enough time in New York City, and I have a part-time faculty position at NYU. I mean, you go into some of those luxury condo buildings, and 20% of the units in that luxury development is set aside for affordable housing, means tested. And somebody may be spending $10 million for an apartment or $1.5 million for an apartment on another floor. And somebody may be spending a few hundred dollars a month, depending on their means, for rent. So I think we've got to take this into consideration. And, you know, the fact of the matter is, there's been conversations in Miami Beach, of course, about how to use municipal parking garages and to build over them to provide affordable housing. But look, from the point of view of a regional economy, this isn't just do-goodism. If the service workers who are fueling our tourism and hospitality industries, that are the engines of our cruise lines, our luxury hotels, our great restaurants, if they have to commute an hour or 2 hours away to get to those jobs because they can't afford to live near where they work, they're going to be demotivated, they're going to be stressed and going to be tired. And if they're making crappy money, they're going to give crappy service. So the way in which we can build a better hospitality and tourism and service economy is by enabling not only call it workforce housing, call it affordable housing, call it workforce housing for the workers to live close to where they work. Pay them a good wage so that they're motivated to do better work. And that's going to lift our tourism and hospitality. What better place, you know, to do this than a place whose literal livelihood, regional livelihood, depends on service workers?
I want to get to this point also in your study. You talk about Miami being an extremely segregated area, not just ethnically, but economically. How bad is this area compared to other cities?
Well, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to know that Miami is segregated. I mean, you drive down the coastline, and on one side of the street, there are multi-million-dollar penthouses and multi-million-dollar homes. And on the other side of the street, as you go westward, you can just see what happened. So, yes, we're like many American cities, segregated. Of course, we add to our economic segregation, ethnic and racial segregation, but many other cities have that. But, you know, what's happened is really the affluent folks, the advantaged folks, have colonized our coastline, obviously, and that's not only people who live here, that's people from all over the world. And they've also not only colonized that, they've colonized the areas close to our urban centers in Miami and Fort Lauderdale, even in Boca. And the areas around research institutions, you know, around all of these research universities and knowledge institutions, now we see strong middle class and upper class populations. And then our poverty and disadvantaged groups have been pushed either into the inner city neighborhoods that are bestride them, or further west. So, yeah, we are a terribly segregated place, and I think that compounds our problems. You know, one of the big problems this country we face is that, you know, I'm a working-class kid from a dad with a seventh-grade education. My dad had enough money to put us to Catholic school. I got a scholarship to go to Rutgers, and I made a decent success of my life. God, you take a kid today growing up with a dad with a seventh-grade education in a neighborhood that's segregated from economic opportunity, where the schools aren't as good as they need to be. Even a kid who grew up in my neighborhood isn't going to make it. So I think that, you know, there's a great study out, by the way, by Raj Chetty. Raj Chetty is a professor at Stanford. Great, brilliant guy. He calls it America's Lost Einsteins. And I think folks need to really, you know, he looks at the kids I grew up with, or the kids growing up in Miami, Latino, Hispanic, African-American kids growing up in disadvantaged neighborhoods. And he shows that those kids have levels of creative and innovative energy and entrepreneurship that are fantastic. They just fall behind because they don't have mentors and support structures and schools. And he calls it America's Lost Einsteins. We're losing all of these potential Einsteins because we don't give them the neighborhood level environment they need to succeed. And that segregation is the big penalty there. So yeah, it's something we need to take very seriously and really harness the creative and innovative and entrepreneurial energies of all of our people.
The Miami Urban Future Initiative, what do you hope that the public and private sector take away from this?
Well, first of all, this is a brand new initiative. I was a co-founder, and maybe my add to it was some of my thought process. Our two big investors are the Florida International University, and particularly the College of Architecture there, but the entire university, and then the Knight Foundation, which provided our seed funding. And the idea here is really simple. If you go to New York or San Francisco or Los Angeles or Boston or London or Toronto, there are a whole range of urban think tanks, people thinking about the region's futures, discussing the region's future, debating the region's futures, convening conversations, bringing in outside experts. We haven't had a lot of that. You know, we've had a boom in our economy. We have a great artistic and creative scene. We've built a great innovative and entrepreneurial economy, but we haven't really hit on this, what we would call this city building, urbanizing function. And the idea was with a small, limited amount of investment, we're going to try to build one. So this Miami Urban Future Initiative is really our attempt to build a think tank, a community-based think tank that can help enrich the conversation, just like we're doing tonight, right? Enrich the conversation about our city and region's future, and bring in outside experts. Take people from our community who are doing interesting things, give them more voice when needed, develop statistics that can track our progress. So that's the idea behind it. And again, we're now just kicking off. We're literally, this is just beginning. And hopefully we'll be able to create something of lasting value to our community. That's our goal.